from Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles. This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Wednesday, March 11, 2009. Treasury official Neel Kashkari takes the hot seat at a congressional panel and tries to explain how the bank bailout funds are being spent. The Justice Department initiates a federal probe into Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio's department. We'll go to Phoenix for a reaction. And we'll wrap up our energy series today and hear about the debate that has deadlocked reform on an 1872 mining law.
This is not your grandfather's mining. Mining today is conducted typically with large earth-moving equipment, dangerous chemicals, including cyanide, and it's conducted by multinational corporations.
I'm Aura Bogado. Those stories after this news.
I'm Renee Feltz with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Thousands of people are attending peaceful protest and church vigils against violence in Northern Ireland after attacks on British security personnel shook the peace process that had maintained calm there for more than a decade. From Dublin, Don Duncan reports.
Today's vigils and services in churches across Northern Ireland are ostensibly in the memory of the two soldiers and one police constable killed in the past 5 days by dissident Republican groups. But they are also a broad-based, cross-community rejection of terrorism. Participants are showing their support for continued commitment by mainstream Catholic and Protestant political parties to maintain peace in the once-troubled province. Despite this unanimous sentiment, people are still worried. Next Tuesday is St. Patrick's Day, a day of enormous political and cultural significance to the Republican communities in Northern Ireland. Many people, as well as members of the intelligence community, are worried a further attack will happen on that day. Northern Ireland's First Minister Ian Paisley of the Unionist DUP party and the province's Deputy First Minister Martin McGuinness of the Republican Sinn Féin party have both pulled out of the annual Shamrock Breakfast at the White House on St. Patrick's Day in order to stay closer to home. For FSRN, this is Don Duncan in Dublin.
In the wake of an attack on four United Nations soldiers in western Darfur, the UN is calling for the United States to resume humanitarian aid and to oppose the Sudanese government's expulsion of non-governmental organizations. Monday's attack on members of the joint UN-African Union mission was the first since the International Criminal Court indicted Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir last week for war crimes. UN spokesperson Nouradine Mesni condemned Monday's attack, saying there's no link between the court's indictment and the peacekeepers' mandate.
We have a specific mandate which has nothing to do with ICC. Our mandate is to protect the civilians, to ensure protection of the aid workers.
Three Nigerians and one Rwandan are being treated for their injuries. On Tuesday, FSRN reported on massive landless protest in Brazil to mark International Women's Day. After our broadcast, hundreds of women from Via Campesina and the landless workers movement were arrested. Mike Fox has this update.
The 700 women arrested at the Ana Paula plantation in the southern Brazilian state of Rio Grande do Sul were released Tuesday evening. They were held without food and National Guard troops destroyed their encampment. The women were also identified, which could allow troops to single out individuals and their families. A spokesperson for the state's workers' movement said the arrests are part of an intensifying campaign in the region. The women had occupied the land to protest the Volturantine Paper Pulp Corporation's increasing production of eucalyptus. They say monocropping eucalyptus for pulp has led to the destruction of natural habitat, resulting in a loss of topsoil and desertification. The released women marched Wednesday afternoon in the nearby city of Bagé. Via Campesina says the protests and occupations launched on Monday are planned to continue throughout the country this week. Mike Fox, FSRN, Porto Alegre.
Back in the United States, President Barack Obama signed a $410 billion spending bill loaded with funding for lawmakers' pet projects. He then called on Congress to enact a series of guidelines that would make earmarks more transparent, saying they're often a vehicle for waste and kickbacks to campaign contributors. The president said earmarks for private companies should first go through a public bidding process. And the fight over same-sex marriage in California has taken a new turn as proponents of a ballot initiative to get the state out of the marriage business start to collect signatures. Kalia Ramirez has more.
A ballot initiative proposed by two straight college students would repeal the recently passed constitutional amendment that recognized marriage as only being between a man and a woman. The initiative would strike the word marriage from all California laws and replace it with domestic partnership. The change would apply to all couples regardless of sexual orientation, but it would keep all the current rights of marriage. Last week, the Los Angeles Times endorsed the concept in an editorial, but Equality California, the state's largest gay rights group, is against it, noting the federal government does not recognize domestic partnerships. Supporters of the initiative have until August 6th to collect close to 700,000 signatures from registered voters to get the measure on the primary ballot in June 2010.
And those are the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. I'm Renee Feltz at the Community News Production Institute in New York City.
Congressional panels spent the day searching for how bank bailout money has been spent. Lawmakers pressed Neel Kashkari, the Treasury official in charge of spending $700 billion in an attempt to relieve the frozen credit crisis. But Kashkari says it's bad business to ask the banks to divulge all the details. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Dan Burton, Republican of Indiana, summed it up here.
I'll tell you, Mr. Kashkari, I don't think there's a member of Congress that really knows where all this money's gone.
$325 billion has been distributed to nearly 500 small and large banks. But many questions remain, like what exactly taxpayers have bought and how the banks have spent that money.
As a businessman, you know, you are hesitant. Business people are hesitant to provide some of their details to their competitors.
Neel Kashkari is the Treasury Department official in charge of the program. The Treasury Department does not require banks to provide the public with details about how they've spent the money. The Troubled Asset Relief Program was originally intended to buy bad or troubled assets, but in most cases, the government bought preferred stock to give banks capital. Damon Silvers, Associate General Counsel for the AFL-CIO, was appointed by Congress to the Congressional Oversight Panel, one of the four mechanisms created to oversee the TARP program. He says a 700-page report found that the government underpaid for preferred stocks by $78 billion. Silver calls it a subsidy.
More than half of the subsidy in the program as a whole went to two institutions, AIG and Citigroup.
Silvers goes on to say that they could not obtain more detailed information because of restricted access.
Despite extensive discussions between our staff and the Treasury Department, Treasury has only produced a small number of the documents the panel requested.
As to the question of how the banks are spending the money, few answers are available. Chair of the Oversight and Government Reform Subcommittee, Dennis Kucinich, questioned why some of the banks are investing overseas. $8 billion to Dubai and $7 billion to the China Construction Corporation Bank.
So how do you justify to the American taxpayers a bank's decision made after receiving tens of billions of dollars in TARP monies to make a $7 billion investment in a Chinese construction company?
Kashkari says the banks are global and determining who they can and cannot work with is bad business. But Kashkari also says it's impossible to specify TARP money.
One of the hardest problems we've had, honestly, I've had in my seat, is communicating this concept of tracking the dollars and where did taxpayer dollars go versus other dollars they got from deposits abroad, as an example. It's this fungibility question that we keep coming back to. And so, Mr. Chairman, it's been very hard for us to say, well, this dollar went for this purpose, the tax dollars went for another purpose.
Democrat Patrick Kennedy of Rhode Island criticizes another oversight mechanism, the Office of the Inspector General.
That 75% of our nation's assets are in the top several banks, and we have 20 people doing the audits of those things.
Congress is considering an expansion of their oversight capabilities. But Nicole Tishon is with the U.S. Public Interest Research Group. She says Treasury should release all details on how the money is spent.
Taxpayers and consumers deserve an open and fair government that will not take them nor their investment lightly.
The Treasury still has the other half, $350 billion, to spend. Though the spending programs have changed, the transparency mechanisms have not. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The Department of Justice has initiated a federal investigation into Maricopa County, Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio's department. Phoenix Mayor Phil Gordon issued two investigation requests to the Justice Department over the past year while the Bush administration was still in power. Congressmember John Conyers called for an investigation under the current administration, and several thousand people recently took to the streets of Phoenix demonstrating against the Sheriff Department's practices. Evan Wyloge is in Phoenix with a look at how local citizens are responding to the news.
Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio usually welcomes the attention his agency's enforcement tactics garner. But over the past several weeks, Arpaio's actions have brought more than just attention. In a statement released Tuesday, the U.S. Department of Justice announced they will formally begin an investigation into Arpaio and the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office in response to repeated allegations of civil rights abuses. The public criticism of Arpaio's office is not new, but since his decision in early February to segregate inmates held on charges of immigration violation, calls for action have come from local, state, and federal officials. Not long after Arpaio implemented his segregated detention facilities and publicly marched inmates charged with immigration status violation, a petition led by U.S. Congressmember John Conyers pled for an investigation into the sheriff's actions. Other complaints include racial profiling of U.S. citizens and immigrants alike. Many of Arpaio's critics hope to see a revocation of the agreement between Arpaio's office and the federal government called a 287G contract. Sheriff Arpaio has previously said he welcomes any investigation into his agency's tactics. Wednesday, Hispanic advocacy groups held a press conference in front of Sheriff Arpaio's office in downtown Phoenix. Randy Perez, one of the co-founders of Maricopa Citizens for Safety and Accountability, also welcomes Tuesday's announcement.
We're seeing now that people have been working on this effort for sometimes more than 2-3 years, and the last year has been really focused on trying to get more federal attention and scrutiny on what Sheriff Arpaio has been doing. And so now we're here to kind of celebrate coming out and saying, look, this has been a year in the making. We're excited and we're looking forward to what the investigation leads.
Perez and others cite the sheriff's seeming disregard for enforcement of violent crime in favor of targeting anyone with an Hispanic appearance.
Some of the tactics that this sheriff has been doing to benefit on the anti-immigrant sentiment in this state has been unlawful. Going after people, regardless of their citizenship status, because if they look brown and they speak Spanish, you're more susceptible to be stopped. You know, it used to be that if you had a broken taillight, they'd pull you over and give you a citation for that. And then you're on your way. No, it becomes a whole third degree. Well, where are you born? Where is this? What's your nationality? Are you a citizen? This sheriff feels that he wants to get some sort of political mileage out of it. We want to end that.
The Justice Department has not specified when the investigation will begin or how it will be carried out, but do emphasize that if civil rights abuses are discovered, further actions to remedy the situation will follow. In downtown Phoenix, Evan Wyloge for Free Speech Radio News.
You won't find the Daily California section in the LA Times anymore. The paper is now featuring the section just once a week on Sundays, and the rest of the week incorporates California stories within existing sections. The LA Times has eliminated another 300 jobs this year, including 70 from the newsroom, and former and current Times reporters are now suing the parent company, Tribune, and its CEO. They say executives broke the law when they approved a leveraged buyout that risked employee pension funds. Patrick Burke has more.
The street price for an LA Times went up another quarter in January. That's also about when the publisher decided to make major changes to the paper, moving state and local news from its own section to the front section.
So it's in front of the foreign and national news, it's in the front section. But inevitably, there'll be less of it, and there's actually less of an opportunity to display that news because it won't have a front page.
Kevin Roderick was an LA Times journalist for 25 years. He broke the story of the California section's fate on his blog, LA Observed, in late January, after Times editors unsuccessfully lobbied for their alternative.
That they fold the business section in with either the news section or with sports, where it used to be.
Instead, business is the new B section, with an emphasis on entertainment. The changes also include eliminating 70 more newsroom positions. By the end of this month, the Times editorial staff will be under 600, about half of what it was in 2001.
Every day you can pick up the LA Times and there's still terrific stories in there. It's just that there are less of them. The paper is continually shrinking.
Henry Weinstein reported at the Times for just under 30 years, covering fraud, the labor movement, and legal issues. Last year he took a severance offer, citing differences with real estate investor Sam Zell, Tribune's new billionaire CEO.
It's not as if the Los Angeles Times is the only paper that it's experiencing these problems. I just think that it's experiencing them in a particularly sort of dramatic and brutal way with a man who's now in charge who absolutely has no interest in quality journalism, makes no bones about that.
Zell's 2007 bid to privatize the Tribune Company involved $315 million from his end, but it also put $8 billion in debt onto the Employee Stock Ownership Plan, or ESOP, giving Tribune a worker-owned structure. Howard Bloom is a Times education reporter.
By having what is considered to be an employee-owned company, you avoid certain tax obligations. Certainly there was no vote among the employees endorsing this plan. It was just a fait accompli, and apparently that's legal.
Not according to reporter-turned-law professor Henry Weinstein, who says employees have no voice in how the company is run.
It's a total mockery.
Weinstein is one of six former and current Times reporters suing Tribune, as well as Zell and several of his business partners. The class action complaint calls for the executives to be removed and for them to give up any personal enrichment that came out of the deal.
Primarily what we say is that in the course of arranging a complicated corporate takeover, Zell and other people violated federal Employee Retirement and Income Security Act, endangering people's retirement, that they violated conflict of interest laws, and that the entire way that this deal was structured was very ill-advised from a business point of view and left the company highly vulnerable.
The 2007 deal tripled Tribune's debt and left it with little flexibility on payments at a volatile time for the newspaper industry. As Kevin Roderick points out, advertisers began to realize several years ago that their ad dollars were no longer well spent on print.
At the same time, readers have been finding their subscription dollars are not well spent with newspapers because you can get almost all the content of most of the newspapers in the country for free on the web.
The recession brought revenues down even further in 2008. In December, Tribune filed for bankruptcy protection to refinance its debt. The company itself is shielded from the litigation while it's in bankruptcy court, and the individual defendants are asking for that same luxury. LA Times and Tribune public relations people would not comment for this story, but Zell has characterized the suit as a distraction full of unfounded allegations. The plaintiffs hope the case will bring in new management at Tribune and restore losses to the employee stock plan. They say they also want Congress to take a closer look at how laws designed to protect workers are instead being used against them. Patrick Burke, Free Speech Radio News, Los Angeles.
And Patrick Burke's video about this story is now on Current TV. You can find a link to that video by going to our website, fsrn.org. A controversial hard rock mining law has been on the books for well over a century, and environmental groups and mining companies have been deadlocked for decades over how to reform it. As Yameshe reports in the last of our energy series, a new crop of conservation-minded Western Democrats in Congress could be the key to a breakthrough.
West Virginia Democrat Nick Rahal has served in Congress for over 30 years. For nearly half of his tenure, he's been trying to change the hard rock mining law.
We're talking about pre-94, traveled the country having hearings on this issue. We have vented and exhausted this issue for decades now, decades.
The law was signed by President Ulysses Grant in 1872, when the West was still a rugged, thinly populated frontier. To encourage settlement, President Grant gave miners a bargain. Anyone could stake a claim on a piece of federal land and extract gold, silver, platinum, and other precious metals without paying royalties to the government. Today, the deal remains pretty much the same, although mining is a far cry from the lone prospector with a pick and shovel.
This is not your grandfather's mining.
Dusty Horwitz studies mining's impact for the Environmental Working Group, an advocacy group based in Washington.
Mining today is conducted typically with large earth-moving equipment, dangerous chemicals including cyanide, and it's conducted by multinational corporations.
Modern mining has left the West pockmarked by huge open pits, and tens of thousands of abandoned craters litter the landscape, many oozing an orange-red, acid-laced runoff called Yellow Boy. The Environmental Protection Agency reports that abandoned mine waste has polluted more than 16,000 miles of western streams. Congressman Rahal says mining companies do not deserve a free lunch anymore.
I certainly feel very strongly that American taxpayers deserve a return for the use of their resources.
He has proposed a 4% royalty on existing hard rock mines and 8% on new ones. The proceeds would be used to clean up abandoned mines. Rahal points out that coal mining and the oil and gas industries already pay royalties of 8% or higher.
The payments that we're asking for the owners of the land, a taxpayer, are minuscule, especially when you look at the price of gold today. That's the major hard rock producer, and I think gold prices up there are pretty good.
But Luke Popovich, spokesperson for the National Mining Association, says Rahal's proposal would kill good-paying mining jobs.
It's hard in the West, generally, in the rural West, and it's almost impossible with today's environment to find jobs that pay what we would call a family wage, where one person can work while someone else is maybe raising the kids, or someone else can work part-time.
Popovich says the industry is willing to discuss royalties in the range of 4 to 5%.
We can negotiate about a lot of issues, but we can't negotiate the expiration of our industry. We can't negotiate over the terms of its death.
The industry does have a guardian angel in Congress. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid is a gold miner's son from the mining town of Searchlight, Nevada. He's probably why Rahal's bill passed the House in 2007, but went nowhere in the Senate. Wyoming Republican Senator Mike Enzi predicts the same thing this time around.
Well, let's see, I've been here 12 and a half years now, and it's been talked about every single year. It's never happened. I think there are an awful lot of projects ahead of that one.
The prospect for reform improved this year when cousins Mark Udall of Colorado and Tom Udall of New Mexico joined the Senate. Both voted for Rahal's bill when they were House members. Here's Mark Udall.
I think there is a sweet spot where the mining industry, public interest groups, citizens in general, legislators agree we could begin to assess royalties.
New Mexico's other Democratic Senator, Jeff Bingaman, who chairs the Senate Natural Resources Committee, has made reforming the hard rock mining law one of his priorities. Senator Reid has said he's open to reform, just not anything that would destroy the industry. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ye Mei Xie in Washington.
You just heard the last story in our Running on Empty Energy series. You can hear many more stories from our series, which explore everything from algae fuel to solar power to the way green jobs might be outsourced on our website, www.fsrn.org. The U.S. has given Pakistan at least $12 billion in military and economic aid to stem Taliban and al-Qaeda militants in that country's tribal areas. But Washington is now facing an even stronger Taliban in the region, and it's considering another financial request from Islamabad. Congressional aides and Obama's administration are reportedly working on a $5 billion package, and President Obama says he will make an announcement about Pakistan soon. Our correspondent in Islamabad, Masroor Hussein, takes a look at the financial side of the war on terror.
For decades, American military strategy in a war has been clear, hold, build, meaning clear an area of the enemy with military might, then hold onto the area and reconstruct it. This was also the American advice for the Pakistan Army in its fight against Taliban insurgency. But not only that the strategy did not work, but Taliban is still at large, and Pakistan economy is showing signs of collapse. Now, Pakistani President Asif Zardari wants a grand plan, something like the Marshall Plan that brought relief to Eastern Europe after the Second World War. Security analysts like Tariq Siyal and President Zardari believe the war on terror brought economic meltdown in the country and warn if Pakistan became a failed state, Taliban, who has established themselves only 200 kilometers from Islamabad, would just walk down the mountains and take over. But the question is, should Washington buy this argument? The reason why Obama administration was reluctant to dole out more money was its suspicion that the aid was not spent appropriately. But now Obama may have to do exactly what former President George Bush did to pump more money. Security analyst Tariq Siyal.
Pakistan mein ye hota hai ki
what normally happens in Pakistan is that the aid does not reach the targeted communities. The result is that those people who have suffered financial losses to their families or have been displaced are unable to benefit from it, which adds up to more poverty.
United States and Pakistan never revealed the exact amount of money spent in Pakistan since 9/11. Various research say Washington may have spent up to $17 billion, $12 billion on overt actions, and $5 billion on covert operations since 2001. How does it work? Pakistan military sends a monthly reimbursement bill worth around $80 million to the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad. The U.S. Embassy pays the money to Pakistan's finance ministry, no questions asked. And a UK media report fears at least 70% of the aid money is misspent. Iftikhar Chaudhry is a former defense ministry analyst in Islamabad who now runs an international media consultancy.
It's true that there must be some check and balances. There must be an inbuilt mechanism to have a check and balances where this fund is going or where this fund is being utilized.
But authorities in Islamabad complain it was the U.S. administration that got Pakistan into this war in the first place. The growing Taliban retaliation against Pakistan hit the economy so bad that it had to borrow from anyone who could lend to stay afloat. Professor Rabia Akhtar heads the Defense and Diplomatic Studies Department at Fatima Jinnah Women University in Islamabad.
Pakistan has suffered a lot of financial losses, many times more than it has collectively received aid from Americans and its Western allies.
IMF paid $7.6 billion last year to help Pakistan head off its balance of payment crisis. Asian Development Bank gave another $300 million. UK has given around $1 billion in poverty reduction program. And now IMF is considering granting another $5 billion. Again, Professor Rabia Akhtar.
Pakistan does face grave challenges, including growing fiscal and current account deficits, rising inflation, growth deterioration, and depleting foreign exchange reserves. Pakistan's participation in international campaign has led to an excessive increase in country's credit risk, which has in turn made borrowing from the market extremely expensive. Frequent bombings, worsening law and order situation, and displacement of local population have taken a toll on the entire socio-economic fabric in the country.
There may not be any quick fixes either for Pakistan's internal crises or the Taliban threats, and the badly conceived war machine on terrorism continues to roll on, taking its toll on both the United States and Pakistan. Masroor Hussain, Free Speech Radio News, Islamabad.
Also in Pakistan, authorities there are clamping down on political activists, arresting hundreds of lawyers and others they deem to be organizing massive anti-government demonstrations planned for Thursday. Opposition party members want judges that were ousted during ex-President Pervez Musharraf's term returned to the courts. Political gatherings have been banned in two provinces, but opposition leader Nawaz Sharif is rejecting the bans on political activity, including protests. And that wraps it up for today's newscast. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. We're supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. You can send us your feedback. Just drop us an email to comments@fsrn.org. That's comments@fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod Joes. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell, and today's headlines editor is Renee Feltz. Our tech team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Rose Katabchi and Oscar Hernandez. From Pacifica Station, KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.